Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What is a woman? It's a question that feminists have posed and interrogated for decades within academia. More recently, however, it's been posed by Rishi Sunak at Prime Minister's Questions to try and trip up Keir Starmer.
The Leader of the Opposition's record on women is questionable at best, Mr. Speaker. And before Labour do start preaching about this issue, they should work out the answer to one very simple question. I'm certain what a woman is he.
In this interview, iconic feminist philosopher Judith Butler exposes the political purpose of this question and why we might not want to answer it, as well as how British turfs have entered into an alliance with the far right, and she addresses those controversial statements on Israel-Palestine.
Am I tough enough?
Strong and stable leadership.
Total rhubarb.
Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
Shut the fridge.
Not another one!
It's the Politics Show cast.
We are going to talk about this weighty tome over the course of the conversation.
Weighty tome.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. Some big ideas in there. Who's afraid of gender? Before, well, and its discussion actually specifically of transphobia in Britain, before we get to that conversation, I think it would be helpful if you could touch on, maybe explain how we can understand what we mean by the term gender, what the word actually means.
Yes, it's a good question. Seems like it's become fairly muddled recently. Well, gender actually was a term that feminists took over from sexology in the 1970s. And it was meant, on the one hand, to describe certain power differentials within society. So you'd have gender division of labor or the gendered character of public life, who's in public and who's not. It was a way of tracking power relations. And then there's also gender identity, which tends to be the identification with being a man, being a woman, or being another category altogether. Those two are separate. They're related. But gender is a way of socially organizing our bodies or socially organizing our common life together. It's not the only way. It's one such way.
And it's important that we kind of, that gender is not a kind of social construction that's distinct from the material body, right? The two are connected to each other.
Well, I think the material body is what gender is working on all the time. How do we live our bodies? How do we experience healthcare? How do we experience aging? There are gendered ways of being in the in health services. There are gendered dimensions of it. There are gendered ways of living our body as young people and then as aging people. So the body is everywhere in gender. We can't have gender without the body.
And categories of men and women can kind of shift contextually and historically.
Well, they already do. I mean, if we look in different languages or we look at different cultures, we see that the way in which men and women are defined are very different. Sometimes they're defined in relationship to kinship or modes of work. Sometimes they're defined in terms of their relationship to land or to history. So feminists have known for a very long time that there are different ways of organizing gender, and feminist anthropologists have been very prominent among those who have insisted on the diversity of gender. So it is, I would add, somewhat surprising that those who call themselves feminists seem now to be opposed to what has been a traditional feminist view.
So why is it that you think then on that point that conversations around gender, trans people, and actually probably most crucially this question, what is a woman?
Yeah.
Why do you think that's become so contentious in more recent history, let's say in the last 10 years or so?
Well, perhaps it's important to acknowledge that it is contentious in the UK in a way that I've not experienced elsewhere. And I'm not sure all the reasons why it is so contentious here, but it may well be that what the National Health Service covers, gender-affirming care, for instance, is a matter of public debate. And so you get a media investment in the debate, and I think it is perhaps interesting or titillating for people to see the debate take form in a very sensationalist way. But of course, it's skewed because it very often sets feminists against trans people. But there are so many trans people who are feminists, and there are so many feminists who use gender as part of their analysis. Gender doesn't belong to the trans movement. It's gender identity, certainly, but gender is something that they're concerned with. But gender, both as identity and as a form of power, has been central to feminism all along. I think what's important for me to emphasize is that there's an anti-gender ideology movement that's taking place in several regions of the world, Eastern Europe and Italy and throughout Latin America, and has been very active for a couple of decades. And for them, to oppose gender is to oppose feminism, to oppose reproductive justice, to oppose gay and lesbian parenting and trans rights. So they're targeting all of us under the term of gender, and yet some of us are arguing with each other as if we're not all, in some ways, being put under the same umbrella by the right, but we are. Unfortunately, they target us, they unify us by targeting us, and we don't know how to unify ourselves in response.
Let's unpick what trans-exclusionary radical feminists actually think. You know, they would assert what they call the sort of the material reality of sex.
Yes.
How do you interact with that claim? Because in the book, you don't deny biology, but
hardly.
You do challenge that assertion.
I'm not sure I challenge the assertion. I think, I don't want to be too academic about it, but the term materiality belongs to a long tradition of materialism. And empiricists and Marxists have been arguing about what constitutes material reality for a really long time. And there are different ways. And I don't know a single Marxist who would say that social relations are not part of the material basis of our lives. They are part of it. Socioeconomic, how are we organized? So feminist history of science, feminist work in biology and developmental biology in particular is extremely interesting, and they are constantly rethinking the paradigms we use to establish sex determination. What are the protocols used? And that's been a debate not only within sexology and gynecology and obstetrics, but also within the feminist history of science. So there's no denying that the body has material dimensions, but how we choose to define that and what value we give to that does differ and has always differed.
Do you think there's a tendency towards, perhaps in our modern political debate, an oversimplification, no matter what it is. It might be to do with gender. It might be to do with climate catastrophe. It could be to do with Britain's departure from the European Union. To introduce a binary, or to take something that actually has quite a lot of contentious debate, whether it's philosophical, whether it's political, whether it's scientific,
yes,
and go, no, it's not that complex. It's very simple, actually, and that perhaps we can understand that sort of the turf inclination there within that broader context.
Well, as I understand the trans-exclusionary feminists who call themselves gender critical, which I can't do because I have a different view of what is critical or what critique is. Mm. As I understand them, they tend to become positivists. And by that, I mean a fact. They claim a fact is a fact is a fact. Now, there are positivists in the world. Karl Popper was a positivist. People just say these are the facts, and this is the way things are, and we have to accept that. And anybody who denies that is either deluded or obscurantist or producing problems where they don't need to be any. But a number of things were called facts, indisputable facts, that we now dispute, including ways of thinking about race or racial categorization and what it means, ways of defining the human, ways of defining the human separately from other living creatures. So it seems to me that there are frameworks within which facts are established, and those frameworks are sometimes quite explicit, and sometimes they're assumed. So if a trans-exclusionary feminist says sex is sex, it's a fact, that's an assertion, and it appeals to common sense. It also appeals to a desire for simplicity, as you note, mm-hmm. right? I don't want to live in a world that's too complex. I just want to have my sex to have other people have their sex. There are two, and I want to navigate the world with that orientation because otherwise I'm lost. It's like, all right, you don't have to be lost. All right, we can draw a map, and the map is going to shift, though, so you have to be careful because we live in history, and there are new ways of seeing things. You may not like them, but it's hard to dispute them. I mean, we could also say that it's a fact that there are trans people. It's a fact that there are gender nonconforming kids. It's a fact that there have always been gender nonconforming kids who said, oh, I don't know how to live with this sex assignment. Or, okay, I can live with this sex assignment, but I have to do something else with it. Or I actually need to change it. Or I may one day want to change it, or I want to hold out that option for myself. Those are facts. Those are facts on the ground, right? We wouldn't have these debates about gender affirmative healthcare if there weren't kids coming in and older people coming in for healthcare looking to change their sex assignment or to make adjustments hormonally or surgically that actually feels like, okay, I can live now in this body and with this sex assignment.
I'd like to ask you a question actually about vocabulary, because I noticed myself in my last question, right? I used the phrase TERF.
Yeah.
You responded, you said trans-exclusionary feminist, and we also spoke as well about gender-critical feminists and why that term is, you know, different for you. But I'm interested, actually, in that term, because initially I would have said that sort of trans-exclusionary feminists, they use that as a self-identifier. It was a phrase that they, you know, descriptive.
Yes.
These are my beliefs. And I actually sort of hesitated away after I said the word TERF, because it's now kind of become almost accusatory, or that there's a sense that it's sort of perceived as persecution, to use that phrase.
I think some people are offended by it. That's true.
And I wonder what political purpose that serves, or how that changes. Maybe it's just sort of quite a, sort of a linguistic point that I'm drilling too deep on, but I don't know what you think of that.
Well, I take seriously that the term is not wanted by those it describes. Mm. Although some use it ironically. Last night, someone in my audience described themselves quite proudly as a British TERF and had a good sense of humor about it. So, you know, I'm trying to make my way here. Mm. I think some would say that their views are actually quite moderate, that they're not against trans people, but that they don't think trans women are the same as women, natal women, and that we need to make a distinction between the two. And I think many trans women, if not most, would say It's not necessary to make that distinction. We just need a broad enough category that includes us all. I tend to go in the more inclusive direction. I don't see why people wouldn't want to go in an inclusive direction. But I don't like gender critical because for that phrase suggests that to be critical of gender is to be opposed to it or to negate it in some way. But critical doesn't mean that. Critical theory, the activity of critique, as Marx pointed out, is the practice of looking at the presuppositions we live with in everyday life and calling them into question, right? I mean, he had this whole beautiful disquisition on this, Marx did, in his early manuscripts. You know, what is the spirit of critique? We take certain things for granted. We take the market economy for granted. We take political economy for granted. And his whole critical method was to say, okay, let's look at the presuppositions and let's see whether they're necessary, how they got established, how they might change. So critique, for me, is a dynamic process. And it also involves imagining the world otherwise. I think it's only very recently that critical, in the sense of gender critical, got reduced to just negation or opposed or don't like, an affective aversion to. And that strikes me as unfortunate because I do think gender theory can be part of critical theory. And so I'm critical. I'm gender critical. Maybe I should be called gender critical.
I think quite often there's a tendency when people consider Marx or Marxism to think, oh, communism. Whereas I actually think, the way I probably would engage with the phrase means it's a way of engaging with the world. It's a system of critique, right? That's kind of what I take it to mean. I'm interested, what was your interaction with the ironic British turf in the audience last night? What did they say to you?
Well, they actually came up to a friend of mine in the face and said, I'm a British turf, because I had exited the stage quickly because I have some anxiety about being encountered in unwanted ways. Yeah. But another one came up to me and said, well, I am on the other side. I'm British and I'm on the other side. And that was, but she said, but I like theory. And I'm going to read your book. And I thought, that's great. I said, be in touch with me if you want to have a dialogue. I thought that was great. I mean, there's no reason why this shouldn't take another form. It's very caustic in the British press. It's full of accusation, complaint, verbal abuse sometimes, shrieking and yelling. I hope with this book to calm things down a little bit so that we can have debates on terms and frameworks to see that we're not as far apart as some people think and that we actually need to think more clearly about what is the alliance between feminism and gay, lesbian, queer, trans movements, because the right-wing movements that oppose us all are also attacking migrants, opposing legislation that would give migrants, guarantee migrants rights to entry and to petition and to have sanctuary in many of our countries. They also, the same right-wing movements that incorporate the anti-gender ideology, are nationalists, very often Christian nationalists. Orban is among the most distinct of those, but we find it throughout Latin America. We find it in Italy with Meloni, who's not clear that trans people should be parents or wants to restrict the methods through which gay and lesbians can have parenting rights. I mean, this is very serious. And in all of these cases, the state is gaining more control over the lives of women, reproductive rights, gay and lesbian people, trans people, rights to self-definition, self-identification, legally and socially. And we should get wiser about this because they are gaining power. And the election of Milei, who's anti-gender in Argentina, is just the latest of these.
I'd be really interested to hear what you think of Meloni specifically. There's
a speech she gave, I think it was after she just won the election, and it was really
declamatory and fiery, actually. And
Marbella.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw it. And it was right before she won the election.
Yeah, and there's a couple of... She says several things, but one of the things that really struck me was, I am Italian and I am a mother.
Yes.
And I found that assertion of motherhood in sort of...
the political context quite interesting.
Yes.
I don't know if you had a view on it or an analysis of it.
Yes, I do. I saw it several times because I did think, as a speech, I mean, she was there at the invitation of the Vox party in Andalusia. And as a speech, she starts very quiet. I'm a mother, I'm a woman, I'm Italian, I'm proud. And then she starts to escalate, and it's an actual fascist anthem by the end. It is a pounding fascist anthem. And she indicts Goldman Sachs, okay, she doesn't want international finance to have control over Italy. But of course, she chooses Goldman Sachs rather than Citibank in order to stoke a little anti-Semitism, although once she's then elected, she's all pro-Israel, which we know is the ticket to showing that you're not anti-Semitic. I'm not sure why that is the ticket, but okay. But she also said that the ideology of gender, and she uses that term, will take your sexed identity away. That if these people get into power, if they have their way in schools and public policy, that you will not be able to be a mother or a father. They will take away those terms. They will destroy the family. And they will take away your sexed identity. In other words, your sex assignment will be canceled by these gender ideologists because that's what they want. Okay. And I just thought, oh my God, this is such a... it's a wild fantasy, but it's not hers alone, right? We can't say, oh, this is a personal fantasy that she has. This fantasy is being communicated publicly through the World Council on the Family and Religion and a number of convocations about social and educational policy on the right. But of course, what she wants to do is deny trans people the right to their sexed identity. So she wants the state power to deny people their sexed identity. Mm. And the way in which she gets that power is by claiming that those very people, right, are going to take yours away. So we need to take theirs away before they take yours away. Mm. That is the argument, as far as I can reconstruct
it
as an argument. Yeah. But it was terrifying, and you saw the swell of emotion on the part of these right-wing people, very excited about doing away with gender, which is, according to the Vatican, a diabolical ideology. That is to say, from the devil, right? So to get rid of gender is to push the devil out of the country, to push a destructive force that's going to take you, your sexed identity, your family, your ability to be a mother or a father. It's going to destroy it all. It's an astonishing kind of attribution of power to to an academic and political perspective that is nowhere near as powerful as it's made out to be. But they're giving us a platform, so we might as well take it.
Thank you for discussing my ideas, Georgia.
I did have to write this book once someone in Brazil yelled at me and they said, pedophile. And I said, pedophile? Where does that even come from? And I guess, it took me a while to figure out what the religious communities were that were learning that gender endorses pedophilia. And what I found is that there was a theologian by the name of Joseph Scala, who had written a book for a Catholic press, which was then translated and into Portuguese, and then made its way into evangelical churches throughout Latin America, which said that if the taboo against homosexuality is broken, then all the other taboos that make us human and civilizational will also be broken. So if you break the taboo on homosexuality, you'll start having sex with animals or children or inanimate objects or whatever it may be. But it was like a Pandora's box that would be opened. So gender in this phantasmatic scene is the obliteration of all moral orientation, all sexual inhibition, and the unleashing of demonic sexual forces. And of course, this is ironic given that the history of pedophilia actually belongs to the church now.
Absolutely. I mean,
they are our first and foremost culprits of child molestation and child abuse. And we know this. This is amply documented. And yet, where do they see the threat of child molestation coming from? From something called gender that no one who actually works in the field of gender can recognize. Mm.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
It's the Politics Show cast.
There's a now infamous open letter written by J.K. Rowling.
Yes.
In which she sets out her reasons for, quote, speaking out on sex and gender issues. You take issue with the line in her letter. This is a quote again. If sex isn't real, the lived reality of women is erased. Erasing the concept of sex removes the ability of many to meaningfully discuss their lives.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, sex is real. But we may not agree on the sense in which it's real. Mm. Sex is real. Sex assignment is real. We wouldn't be having these debates about trans rights to sex assignment if sex wasn't real. But sex changes through time, what we mean by sex. There are a number of historical works that talk about sex in the category of sex and its various definitions. They were no less real just because they were defined differently in the history of Europe or the history of the US or the history of any number of regions in the world. Most people don't disarticulate the reality of sex from the lived reality of people. So her argument is that we have to have sex as real, and then we can meaningfully talk about how we live our sex. And I guess my only difference would be to say that the way we talk meaningfully about sex has everything to do with what counts as real. And there are people who are saying that's real and that's not real. They're deciding whose reality is legitimate and whose is not. And I don't think we can get away from that. So one way of getting power in that debate is to say my definition of what's real is the only one. Mm. Or is the obvious one. Or so I don't think to say that gender is constructed means it's artificial or unreal. Gender only operates in relationship to the category of sex. But the minute we talk about sex assignment is happening with an infant, we're talking about an interaction between hospital, a legal regime, and a body, a perceptible features of that body, and an organization of that life. Sex assignment comes with social power. Sex assignment comes with parental and societal fantasies about what it means that you have a boy, what it means you have, it's a girl. There's already a set of expectations that are like right there in sex assignment. So it's all too real, but it's also a social reality. Do we want to say the social reality is not real? Do we want to say lived reality is not real? No. So she and I agree there. I just don't think her assertive way of deciding the reality of sex can be the basis for a general discussion in which people are, in fact, disagreeing about how that reality should be defined. Mm-hmm. It's not a question of reality and unreality. And I think that's a misunderstanding of what construction is all about.
I think people like her, well, yeah, Rowling and other trans-exclusionary feminists, would argue that their main concern is safety.
Yes.
The safety of women assigned female at birth.
Yes.
We saw it in the debate around self-ID laws. They tried to pass them in Scotland, and this phrase over and over again is sort of safety, right?
Right.
Do you find that argument compelling, that something like self-ID laws threatens the safety of women assigned female at birth?
I don't find it compelling. I'm very concerned with safety, but I would be as equally concerned for a gender non-conforming kid who's bullied at school, or a trans woman who is put in a men's prison and harassed, violated, or murdered as a result. I would be concerned for a trans man who is also treated in a discriminatory or violent way. Why wouldn't we be concerned for all those people if they're all at risk of being harmed? I mean, trans people, gay, lesbian people, women are all at risk on the street. Why wouldn't we want a politics that's broad enough to care about all of them and include migrants and people of color and others who suffer vulnerability in public domains?
It's not
the homeless.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a contradiction for all of these groups of people to be safe simultaneously.
No, it's not a contradiction. And I think setting it up as a contradiction just means that the framework isn't broad enough. Go back to the drawing board. I mean, it would be ridiculous to say, oh, I'm against discrimination and violence against this group, but this group, it's okay. Like, I don't mind so much. It's like, no, you want to universalize your claim.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I do.
I do as well. Are those people on the other side of the argument wrong to point out that there have been instances in which trans women have committed acts of violence against women? Is it the conclusion that's drawn, which I have a problem with, this idea that because someone of a certain category commits a crime, that therefore you come to a conclusion about everyone in that category, right? It's prejudicial.
It's very prejudicial. We wouldn't accept it if a person of North African descent commits a crime in London and then a bunch of politicians decide we need to contain or expel or disenfranchise people of North African descent. We would say that's racist and discriminatory. Or if a Jewish person charges you too much, and then we decide, oh, all Jews charge too much, or they're usurers or, you know, financiers of a certain kind, we would say that's anti-Semitic and it's really not acceptable. Or one Arab person commits a violent act, that doesn't mean that all Arab people are violent. And we're seeing that now, of course, in Palestine, where the generalization is extended to every person in the population when it clearly ought not to be. So we need to combat that kind of discriminatory generalization. I guess I would just add to that we do acknowledge that there are instances where trans women in prison did attack other women, and that's wrong. But if we ask ourselves who's committing violence in prisons, I think, and who's committing it against women of any kind, I think we would find guards to be the most violent of them. So there's a category we haven't even mentioned. There is violence of women against women, women guards against women, also sexual violation. I think we need a bigger picture of how violence is taking place and who is responsible for prison violence. And then we can have a perspective on how frequent trans women are, in fact, perpetrators of violence. And my informed wager would be not very frequently.
Yeah. You can view the whole thing, right, as an extension of state violence, right? State power, the actual penal system.
Yeah.
I'm really glad you made the point about sort of political tendencies, particularly actually in relation to Britain, to sort of, because, you know, a Muslim kills people, that we then go, we politically draw like a huge conclusion about Muslims in general.
Yes. Right?
It's happening in Britain at the moment. You know, Lee Anderson, former member of the Conservative Party, right, says that Sadiq Khan, because he is a Muslim, you know, he's mates with extremists, Islamist extremists, right? We see it with the ceasefire marches that are happening in London, where you have hundreds of thousands of people calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, and they get called hate marches.
Yes.
And I'm really interested in this kind of authoritarian alliance between, to keep it grounded in gender for a second, between trans-exclusionary feminists and the authoritarian right, and that connection between the two.
Yes, well, I think it's important to note that, well, in the U.S., Christopher Rufo, for instance, who's part of Republican right-wing punditry, he's responsible both for our late anti-gender ideology movement in the U.S. came much later than Eastern Europe and Europe more generally and Latin America. He's also against critical race theory and against the idea that slavery is being taught in schools in such a way that it indicts the United States as a racist country, or that the United States in its origins is a racist country. Now, I don't really know how you dispute that claim, given the genocide perpetrated against Native peoples, but also the fact that slavery began with the first boats that came, you know, to discover America. There was no temporal lag between the founding of the country or even the discovery of the continent and the importation of slavery. It's like coextensive throughout all time. So these same people who are against gender are against teaching about the history of racial violence, the struggles for racial justice. They are also almost always anti-migrant, and we see that in Hungary, where Orban explicitly comes out against miscegenation, because for him the natural family, man, woman, child, two children, three children, whatever, is also the national family, right? So he does that slippage. But he wants to reproduce the racial purity of the nation, and miscegenation gets in the way of that. And Putin, too. I mean, Putin has said gender is also a threat to the national security of Russia. Well, in what sense? Like, we're not exactly at the border, you know, like, trying to enter. But we are apparently threatening to enter through the European Union, you know, which he calls gay ropa. But he said quite explicitly in 2015 that gender threatens the spiritual values of the country, and in that sense is a national security issue. So the war on gender is about Christian Orthodox, in that case Russian Orthodox, foundations for the authoritarian state, which seeks to order sexuality, family, gender, and it has subsequently suppressed all publications advocating for gay, lesbian rights, much less trans rights. And all of this is assembled under the anti-gender ideology movement. But I think authoritarians are doing something else. They're promising to restore an order that has been lost. Mm. So it's not just a backlash, in my view. It's a restoration project. So Meloni, it's like, I'm Italian, I'm traditional. Which she never was. I mean, you know, she was living with this guy outside of marriage, has this kid outside of wedlock, then leaves him. Now she's a single mother, relying on friends and cousins for childcare, like everybody who's in blended or complex kinship arrangements. But she can speak as if that complexity doesn't exist, which is all, apparently, the Italian conservatives care about. Mm-hmm. I did issue an invitation in the Italian press to her. She could join the queer community now that she's a single mom, looking for kinship in other places besides the nuclear family, which she's always done. Anyway, sorry.
Do you think she'll be accepting your invitation?
I'm not going to hear from her.
I will say in my head as well, I've got this conjured image, right, of theorists and academics, like, marching through Belarus towards Moscow.
Crazy, crazy. But there is this fantastical dimension to this whole attack.
I really like, fantasy is a great word for it, because actually, and particularly what you're talking about with authoritarianism, I can speak, certainly in Britain, that this idea of the kind of the mystified past, that actually very often the idea of Britain, or actually sometimes the idea of England quite specifically, is a mythical one. It's one that never existed. The idea that, you know, land of milk and honey, or, you know, with milkmaids riding bicycles through foggy lanes, this idea of a Britain that they try to conjure, I don't actually think is one that ever exists. It's so central to, particularly in British politics, we love to talk about, in relation to the Second World War, for example, you know, our darkest hour when we stood alone.
Yes.
Simple fact, you know, at least more than a third of the pilots that fought in the Battle of Britain are Polish, right? You know,
yes.
It's this idea that it's just the Englishman stood.
No, I understand.
It's a myth.
But it's part of the Brexit poll.
Yeah, so I'd invite you to sort of engage with that sort of the power of myth, right? And particularly for the authoritarian right.
Well, I do think that we have to acknowledge that a lot of people are living with a fear of destruction right now. They do feel that their livelihoods are undermined. We have accelerating neoliberal economic regimes. We have the devastation of social services. Nobody I know in the UK feels quite secure about getting a medical appointment with the NHS.
Yeah.
Some people, you know, flying to Munich to get basic procedures done, really. I mean, I'm kind of shocked.
Mm.
But I do think people feel, and are right to feel, that their way of life is threatened. Will they have job security? You know, jobs are increasingly precarious. They worked in manufacturing, what's left of the manufacturing base. If they worked in social services and those are cut back, what's left of their job? What's happening to their pension? How's that getting readjusted? I think there's a lot of economic anxiety. There's anxiety about the earth. Climate change, people experience it in a daily way and they don't know what to make of it. Fossil fuels are kind of an abstraction. They understand there have to be limitations, but do they really want to give up everything that they rely on in life? And war, I mean, we're seeing open-ended wars that we don't know how they're going to end. I'm not sure we can call the Israeli bombardment of Gaza and the slaughter of civilians of war. It's a campaign of slaughter at this point that is just appalling. But how will it end? And will it ever end?
Mm-hmm.
And Ukraine, we don't know. And other parts of the world are also explosive and violent. And I think people have a fear of destruction. Authoritarians come along and they say, oh, you know what's destroying your life? These progressive social movements, these people who want abortion, or these people who want equal rights or protections against discrimination, or, oh, that Istanbul Convention that protects women against gender-based violence. They don't like that. They're anti-feminist, right? I mean, all the more reason J.K. Rowling should join me, right? If we liked that provision of the Istanbul Convention, we should be fighting the anti-gender ideology movement. So they're trying to identify what the source of destruction is and produce themselves new emergent authoritarian regimes with strong state powers that are fundamentally anti-democratic as those who can promise a restoration of order, starting with the family, starting with your sexed identity. You're a man, you're a father, nothing's going to take that away. I think appealing to the most intimate fears that people have at the same time that they're having a more generalized fear of the destruction of their way of life is a very good kind of, a very effective political appeal to arouse passions of anxiety, fear, hatred that work to the advantage of authoritarians because they're going to give us back the world as an ordered and harmonious thing. And whether that's a national version, like, oh, the older Britain, or some version of community and family that people are missing or fear losing, depends on the region.
I think another point of connection between that sort of authoritarian right and the trans-exclusionary feminist is this invocation of cancel culture, right? Of being a victim of cancel culture, that in some way their free speech is under attack, or that actually perhaps an ideology is being imposed on them that they disagree with. Do you find that argument compelling?
Well, no, because the at least here, the attack on gender studies departments and the threat to shut them down is actually mobilized by the trans-exclusionary feminists. And so who's shutting down whose speech exactly? I mean, there's a huge amount of censorship coming from the right. And in the U.S., we're seeing sex education classes shut down. We're seeing books from the library, local libraries, taken off the shelf that concern single mothers, single fathers, gay and lesbian parents, sexuality, anything affirmative of women's right to choose. So the censorship efforts are legally and politically coming from the right. It's one of those cases, and we might think of Naomi Klein's doppelganger in this way. It's one of these cases where the very operation of censorship that the right is imposing is what they accuse the left of doing. And it produces a general confusion in the public, like, oh, where is censorship coming from again? Is it the left or is it the right? And to a certain extent, they seem to be mirror images, and we don't know how to distinguish between them, which is why we need more acute analyses of how these political strategies are devised and how they work and why they work.
We interviewed Naomi Klein here about doppelganger, so I would encourage viewers to go and check out that interview. It's very, very compelling.
Yes, it is.
Okay, just one more question on the right, and particularly in relation to gender. I'd like to... There's a refrain coming more now in our parliament, which is quite typical, actually, of the Prime Minister's question sessions, where Rishi Sunak will say to Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party...
I know. Yeah, go ahead.
You know where it's going, yeah. You know...
How do you define a woman?
Yeah, what is a woman? He doesn't even know what a woman is, and also...
And we're supposed to love, and that's a ridiculous thing.
Sex matters is another one that he says, and I'd like to invite you to... yeah, that's what he's saying. To talk a bit about the political function of him using those kind of words and making these kind of points. What purpose does it serve for him to speak like that?
Well, maybe just as a prefatory remark, the way in which feminism began was by calling into question received notions of what a woman is, right? They tell you you belong in the household. They tell you you're good for reproduction. They tell you you're not able to do that kind of work. You can't engage in sports. You can't be a public speaker. You certainly can't be a politician. You can't be an intellectual, or if you are, you're never going to be quite as good. So what has feminism been about? It's been about contesting received ideas of what a woman is. Why did we start women's studies, feminist studies, gender studies? Well, we did because we wanted to call into question these presuppositions that had been taken for granted for too long. So we ask the question, what is it to be a woman? Or what does it mean to be a woman? Simone de Beauvoir, one is not born, but rather becomes a woman. Really? It's not biologically, it's not the biological function that makes you a woman? No, it's not the biological function. It's actually nothing specific about the biology that alone defines you as a woman. It's part of the picture. But how you live that, what you do with that, is a question of history. It's a question of freedom. It's how you negotiate your situation, which is an historically complicated one, where there are established norms and roles. So feminism has always kept the question open, what is a woman, and refused to answer it. Refused to answer it on principle, because we don't know all the things women can be and do, and we're not about to say in advance, this is who you are. Stay within your limits. Stay within this category. We've decided this is what a woman is, and you have to live there. It's like, no, we don't do that. We're a freedom struggle, right? We're an emancipatory struggle. We are in the process. Also, we're transnational and we're multilingual. So what a woman is in various parts of the world differs radically, which is why we have anthropology and history and political science that is cross-regional and global in all kinds of dimensions, because we don't want to be parochial and say, oh, what some London feminist thinks a woman is the extent of what a woman is all through the world. No, that's cultural arrogance. We don't do that.
There's a quote in The Second Sex that's like, woman, question mark, very simple for those who like very simple answers. And I think it sums it up so neatly, and I don't understand why people don't respond to that question, like, he can't say what a woman is. It's like, yeah, because there's like thousands and thousands of pages of literature contesting the very question. Like,
well, a whole lot of women would rise up against him if he did. Quite frankly, we don't want some man telling us who we are. No, that's just not going to happen.
Before we finish up, yeah, so I'll stop talking there, Judith.
One reason we don't define women and tell everybody this is what a woman is, and we now, all of our studies and all of our politics follow from this common definition, is because we actually believe in self-definition, which we give to ourselves, and why don't we give it to trans people? I'm not sure.
Point very well made. Before we finish up, we've spoken a couple times in reference to what's happening in Gaza right now.
Yes.
And I saw a previous interview you did, I think it was with a French publication, where you were talking about the nature of October 7th. And sort of the inclination to call it a terrorist attack and the kind of to denude it of the context of Israeli occupation. And I just, I'd like to start by asking you to talk about that a little bit, because I don't really want to sort of like question the things you said there without hearing you say them now, if that makes sense.
Yes, well, I think there were some clips of that discussion that circulated by Ben Shapiro and his friends on the right.
And Rufo as well, yeah.
Yeah, and Rufo. Nice to know he's part of it. but look, I have always and consistently opposed the atrocities committed by Hamas on October 7th, and that part of my position has never changed. I do think that within Palestine there are those who are in favor of armed struggle and others who are trying to seek diplomatic means to achieve greater self-determination or even liberation for Palestine. So I think it's worthwhile understanding why people do sometimes go for armed struggle. I think war brings with it sexual violence, and we've seen it on both sides, and it's deplorable. One reason I am against war and why I am actually a proponent of nonviolence and have been for many, many years, as far back as I remember, is that I long for and call for a mode of cohabitation in Palestine and Israel-Palestine that would actually give radical equality, freedom, and self-determination to the Palestinian people, as well as all the other inhabitants of the land. I've thought a lot about the one-state solution. I've done a lot of work recently thinking about binationalism. What would a federated authority look like? What's the history of calling for a federated binational vision? I've been reading material from the 30s and 40s when people were hoping that whatever state emerged in 1948 would be binational and would guarantee equality for all people. I want a political solution. I actually want a constitutional solution. I am not an advocate of violence, and I don't believe that understanding historically how Hamas formed after the bitter disappointment of the Oslo Accords, and understanding how its aims were established and how its aims were revised in 2017, that I think it would be useful to understand how they formed so that we might be more effective in convincing them to lay down their arms. That is my view. And unfortunately, though, you could just call them terrorists and be done with it. You could just call them evil and be done with it. But then we're learning nothing, and we're not learning how we might find an end to violence, which is my ultimate goal.
I do shy away from using the phrase terrorism, right? Because I think it nearly always is a pejorative. It's nearly always used to describe your opponents. And whilst with the lexicon, we might use the lexicon of, you know, to describe the bombardment of Gaza as a war crime, why is it that, you know, what Hamas did on October 7th, why don't we say that that's a war crime? Why do we say that that's terrorism? And I often think the distinction is essentially kind of reveals your own biases.
Yes.
I understand that point.
Yes.
The thing I struggle to understand that I heard you say in that that previous interview, I think you used the phrase, you said that it wasn't an anti-Semitic attack. And I didn't really understand what you meant by that. Could you talk about that a
little bit? Yes. Well, I think we've all seen, or many of us have seen, footage where Hamas militants are jubilant about having killed Jews.
Yeah.
So that is clearly anti-Semitic, and there's no question about that. Do we think that Hamas is committing violence against Israeli citizens because primarily they are anti-Semitic? Or do we think that these violent acts are part of a larger struggle to emerge from colonial domination? I think we have to open that question. I'm not saying that anti-Semitism isn't part of it. For many Palestinians, the only Jews they've ever met have been soldiers. I remember going to Ramallah and meeting people who said, oh, the only Jew I've ever met is a soldier. You're the first one. And I was like, wow, really? What does that do to your idea of what a Jew is? So, but I think if we say it's only or exclusively anti-Semitic, that they just hate the Jews, we're not understanding that they also hate living under colonial subjugation. Gaza has been under siege for decades. When it wasn't literally occupied as it is now, it was still under siege, and it did not have autonomy as a state or as a political entity. Doesn't have rights of movement. It doesn't have control over its own electricity and water, or even the amount of food or building materials that can come in through the border. It is surrounded by soldiers and has been. So that people want to be liberated from that life is no surprise. And I think if we say, oh, they just hate the Jews, we imagine that they would be happier being colonized by another group of people. So how do we think about the anti-colonial struggle and the way it is intermixed with anti-Semitism in this instance? I think it's complex, it's sensitive, but it certainly deserves some careful thinking.
Judith Butler, it's been revelatory having you here. So grateful for you making the time. Thank you.
Thank you.
The book's called Who's Afraid of Gender? Thank you for taking the time.
Okay.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.